This interview is brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. You can check out the full episode at lickinonlending.com.
Stephen, so good to have you with us. Appreciate you joining us and helping our listeners get updated on a number of really important things going on in the industry.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
There's so much we could talk about. First of all, let's let our listeners know who you are and get to know a little bit about your company.
Yeah, great. So basically, our company helps mortgage companies nationwide with getting licensed in different states and also keeping those licenses, maintaining them, renewing them, doing reports, that type of thing. And we've been doing this for over 10 years now, so we have quite a bit of experience with that and deal with it on a day-in, day-out basis. And that's all we do. So we have a good specialty focus on just licensing services.
Well, you do an amazing job on it. You are our go-to person. You're affordable, you're thorough, and so helpful. So anyone's looking for help in anything you're going to be talking about in these areas, I encourage you to get a hold of Stephen. So let's get into some of the things. You've been doing this for 10 years. Has there been a lot of changes in licensing overall in what goes into it, especially at the state level?
Yeah, definitely. So the one major thing that's been happening, as most people are aware, is that the states have been trying to come together and make things a little bit more efficient. Of course, the NMLS, when it came out in 2009, helped with that dramatically and tried to make things a little more streamlined and a little similar across the board from state to state so that you're not having to repeat things over and over. But another thing that's going on recently is a lot of the states, as they're trying to make things more efficiently, are also seeing that it's not as efficient as they would like. And so a lot of the states are pushing when somebody submits an application with deadlines now. And they're giving people as much as maybe 2 months to as little as a couple of weeks to respond to things. So we're also seeing a lot more issues recently with applications getting abandoned when people aren't responsive, that type of thing. So unfortunately, although it's a good thing that the states are getting efficient, we're also seeing the states kind of being a little bit more maybe pushy to try to get things efficient on their end as well.
Well, Stephen, there's need for efficiencies because it is an inefficient process and it's confusing, and someone who is not familiar with it really can struggle, and I think that's one of the values of your service. Let's start getting into the various components. Let's start with surety bonds, if you wouldn't mind. Almost every state now requires some type of licensed mortgage company to have a surety bond. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So one of the main things is that a lot of people are confused about what a surety bond actually is. A big misconception when we get calls about those is they think they're similar to an errors and omissions, you know, policy.
Right.
And they think that it actually is a protection for them, when in fact, the surety bond is actually a liability to the company, provides them no protection at all. If there is any sort of issue with a customer or with the state or a vendor, the state can actually make a claim on that bond, and then the bond company will pay it out and then go after the mortgage company. And if the mortgage company doesn't pay it back, they'll go after the owners generally, if the owners and their spouses personally indemnify those bonds. So because the surety bond is actually a liability for the company, you have to get that approved, similar to getting a mortgage approved. You have to go in and go to the surety bond companies and tell them how much bond coverage you need. And then they will look at your credit and determine what type of rate you could get and determine if you even qualify to get those bonds. So generally, it's not a problem if you're just doing just a couple states, getting licensed in 3 or 4 states. But once you start doing maybe 10 or more, then it can start to become an issue where you may not be able to get those approved if you don't have good enough credit or high enough net worth.
So talk about that. Is there some net worth formula? So, for example, let's say you're having 5 states. Let's say do 10 states, which makes it real simple for the math purpose. If you have 10 states and you're going out, and most states, you say, I believe you've told me in the past, it said they require somewhere between $10,000 and $100,000 surety bond. So that is, it's a liability of the company. So for someone that's going after 10 state approvals and therefore needing 10 surety bonds, does that then, if they're each of the states assuming they need $100,000, does that mean you have need to have $1 million net worth? And if you don't, is there some formula that you go and walk us through there?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So, Yeah, in your scenario where you're needing $1 million worth of surety bonds for 10 different states, that can be difficult to get approved. Like I said earlier, it really comes down to the credit of the owners of the company and their net worth, as well as the net worth of the company itself. And depending on that, then the surety companies will determine how much bonding coverage they're willing to give. A lot of times, and especially in the past, when things when they were having a lot more issues in the 2010 area, they were looking for a 1-to-1 ratio. So if you wanted $1 million in surety bonds, they would want to see the company has $1 million in net worth. In recent years, they've started to lax up on that, and we're starting to see 1-to-2 ratios or even 1-to-3 ratios, where you want $1 million in surety bonds, they'll give it to you if you have $200,000 or $300,000 in net worth. Or they'll be able to offer it to you for a little bit higher rate.
Yeah. So what are the rates for the cost of a surety bond?
So they can be as low as we've been seeing, even as of these last few months, as low as 0.5%, which would mean $100,000 surety bond, about $500. But the average is about 1%. So $100,000 surety bond would be about $1,000. And then we're also seeing, if somebody has major credit issues or lower net worth, we're seeing as high as 3% or even as high as 10%.
So it really is based on, it really starts with the credit report of the individual owning the company or individuals. So in that scenario, there's multiple, let's say there's four owners in a company, not uncommon these days, where people have cobbled together the necessary net worth to become a mortgage banker and get licensed and go into various states. And let's say that there is one or two of the owners that had some previous credit history issues. How does that factor in?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it definitely definitely could cause the rate to go up, or it could cause a surety company to come back and say, we can't offer all of the surety bonds that you're looking to get. It really is like an underwriting process similar to a mortgage loan. And it's not as in the mortgage industry, it's fairly straightforward. Almost all investors have very similar underwriting guidelines. It's not so in the surety company industry. There's not as much of a similarity between the surety companies. And so sometimes if you can't seem to get it through one surety company, you can go to another and have them underwrite and see what they can offer to you.
So like a good mortgage broker who can take a borrower's loan to multiple mortgage lenders and submit it, I'm assuming it's a part of your service, is that you find a surety bond that's the best fit based on the profile of the individual. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, we're not actually a surety bond broker, so we don't actually go and search around for different surety companies. We have connections with different surety bond brokers, which we would connect companies up with, and they would do that for them and help them find that. And they have to be licensed insurance brokers, basically, to offer that service.
Okay. I mean, so this is really helpful because I think a lot of people think, well, a surety bond, E&O insurance is one and the same, and it's distinctly not. And there is a deeper look at this. Do you help with E&O insurance as well?
We don't actually offer it again, but we do know many surety companies and insurance companies that can offer those, the errors and omissions and the fidelity bond coverage. And that type of thing. And we can refer people out as they need that, especially if they need it for licensing.
Let's talk about, you know, a lot of people say they have a homeowner's insurance company, they're dealing with several insurance company or several insurance brokers out there. And it's not uncommon to say, oh, yeah, let me handle that for you. Any words of wisdom or tips that you would say, caution that you'd offer someone seeking a surety bond?
Yeah, definitely. If you're wanting to get a surety bond, you don't want to go to generally a homeowner's insurance company, because that's not what they specialize in. They're not going to be familiar with all the ins and outs of getting the best rate for you, of underwriting those types of policies. And they're generally not going to know how to navigate the forms that need to be filled out for the state licensing agencies, as well as now a lot of the surety bonds are posted online on the NMLS. And so your surety company needs to have access to that. And if you use just a local homeowner's insurance company, they're going to have to go through a lot of hoops to try to get access or to get someone else to do it for them, kind of like a co-brokering situation. So it doesn't really work very well in my experience to use someone you know. It's better to use insurance company that specializes in surety bonds.
That is good information, and we've got so much to cover. I want to move on to the next topic, and anytime you're working with a company to get them state licensed and approved with HUD or with a state license specifically, fingerprints and or a criminal background check is performed. That has gotten, if I understand correctly, that has become more extensive. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. Now every state is checking that when you apply for a license as a loan originator. And most states are checking that when a company applies for a license with the state. And they're checking that on the owners and officers of the company. And most states now use just the FBI criminal background check, which is done through the NMLS fingerprinting process, which is great. Which means that you just have to be fingerprinted one time, and those results can be sent to each state that you want to get licensed in. But there's still a handful of states that require state-specific background checks. And if anything comes up on those, they will generally require full documentation and explanation of what occurred. And then, of course, there are certain things such as certain types of felonies and situations like that where you may not be able to get licensed for a certain period of time or ever get licensed based on what it was.
Let's talk a little bit more about the criminal background check. Someone might say, okay, I'm really nervous about this, the conscientious ones. They say, I've had a traffic ticket. I've had, I was young in college and did some stupid things, and I had a run-in with the law. I mean, what comes up as a line for you where you can reassure them they're not going to be approved? How far back did it go? Is there a statute of limitations? All of those things related to the criminal background check that you think is important that our listeners know.
Yeah, so they're going to look back all the way as far as they can. And even if you've had it removed off of your record, you still have to actually report it to the state licensing agency if it did occur, unless you've had it pardoned by a governor or dismissed. You still have to report that. Generally, though, in almost every state, it's not an issue unless it was a specific type of felony that was financial related or theft or fraud, or if it was a felony within the last 7 years. As long as it doesn't fall into one of those two categories, a misdemeanor or obviously a traffic violation, something like that, or even just a charge against you that was dismissed, you generally are not going to, it's not going to be used against you, but they may ask for documentation so that they can look at it and verify that it's not a felony that falls into one of those categories.
And really, what's the purpose of this criminal background check? I mean, it's keeping the bad guys out of the business, but are there some people that are really concerned about this? Is it something that's you should not take lightly is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, you definitely want to be very careful whenever you're filling out any application or information in the NMLS system, or if something's happened and you've gotten a misdemeanor and you need to disclose that. You want to do that right away, because some states, you know, will take that very seriously if they find out about it, but you didn't disclose it to them. And if you had disclosed it to them, it would have not been a big deal at all. But just because they think you were hiding it, that can turn into a major issue. Yeah. So it's really important to go ahead and make sure to disclose those things and review that regularly if you have any criminal issues. But again, it's not really an issue as long as it's not a felony, especially not a felony that was financial related. It's generally not an issue. And we usually go over that with our customers up front to make sure they don't have those types of problems. And if they do, we don't even apply. And so a lot of times these criminal background checks really just pull up old things that are misdemeanors that people had when they were younger. It's kind of just an extra step we have to go through to make sure to disclose that to the states properly.
Very good. The most important part of this is you help people through this. You really work with people they can talk to you openly about things. Is this an issue? Should I cover it? And that's one of the services you provide. And it's very valuable. And there's been people that have called me and go, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad I talked to Stephen. I was really nervous about something, and they don't want to talk about it with me. But they said, you were just wonderful to talk to. Very comforting. You weren't condemning. It was just like you deal with it on a very factual basis, and you help several people through it. So very helpful. Let's switch over to talking about education experience and exams. When companies are wanting to get approved at different states, these are all very important issues. What is going on in this area of education experience and exams? Any changes? It seems to have tightened. Are we seeing that trend continue?
Yeah. So with the adoption of the Uniform State Test, which most listeners will be aware of, that happened in 2013, now there's only one state test for loan originator licensing. Every state as of, I think, this last month, July or August, has adopted the Uniform State Test. So there's now just the national NMLS test for loan originators. And then on top of that, there's the education requirement, which is the 20 hours of federal education. And then about 30 or so states require a couple hours of state-specific education as well. But yeah, with that, with the adoption of that uniform state test, it turned the testing over to something very, very simple now. I remember when we first started in 2009, I had a customer that wanted to be licensed in every state in DC, and they had to take 52 tests. It was pretty overwhelming. But now that's just one. In regards to getting a company license, so there still are a few states that require a state-specific test, California BRE, which is the Bureau of Real Estate,
right.
Utah requires one, Washington as a mortgage broker, but not necessarily as a lender. So there still are a few that have specific testing, but it's only for one person within that company, and it's only a one-time thing so that company can get licensed. It's not a requirement for the individual loan originators. And then when the states did adopt the Uniform State Test, they definitely decided to start adopting state-specific education instead of the state testing for loan originators. So we've seen a lot more of that recently, and I think we'll continue to see that increase until probably most, if not all, states have some sort of few hours of pre-license education and a few hours of continuing education each year, because it's really a better way for the states to make sure that their material and their compliance requirements are in front of these loan originators and company owners is by having these required education courses each year. That's a whole lot better, they found, than the testing they tried to do for each state in 2009.
Is there anything that you could say about the educational component? What are the things that you would recommend to a client when it comes to the actual education? We're seeing so many people out there with so many educational programs, and they're certainly not all equal. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's hard to say which companies to go with. A lot of people prefer one over another. Some people prefer doing their continuing education live each year at some sort of event that they're going to anyway, conference or something like that. So it just really depends on what they prefer. I say the best thing to do is find one that you like, that's not burdensome to sit through, or at least not too burdensome,
yep,
and something that's not too expensive. So comparing the pricing, because that does fluctuate quite a bit between companies as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a traffic ticket. You can go to school, and there's all these different types of schools, and there's some that are humor, and they use humor, but some you can do online. So it really is a personal preference thing, and what works best for you. But you guide people through that again, correct?
Yeah. For the most part, we tell them what they need to do, what education, and then we give them a few companies that we recommend, and then they can choose to go with one of them or find one on their own. It's really up to them, again, based on their preferences.
Let's move over to talking about information relating to director information, officer information, and really the ownership, those that are in ownership. Every state requires you to provide details on the owners and officers and directors, but is, again, what are the trends there and what type of information are they looking for?
So every state's going to require that the owners and officers be disclosed within the NMLS. So it's going to be the same exact information that a loan originator needs to fill out, their employment history, residential history. They're going to have to answer some questions about their background, like we talked about their criminal background, but also credit background, any regulatory actions, any civil actions against them. And they're going to have to disclose all that information. But on top of that, many states still require additional information to be sent outside of the NMLS. Some states even require personal financials on the owners and even officers in some states. Some states require resumes outside of what's already put in the NMLS. Even though it's the same exact information, they want a little bit more detail about the job descriptions in some cases. Some states will ask for all kinds of different information. New York, for example, will even ask about your parents, siblings, and children,
wow,
and spouse, and everything, because they want to make sure that you're not related to anyone that has committed some sort of fraud in New York, I guess. And so it just depends on the state, but there's quite a bit of information that these states ask for on the owners and officers.
And that's outside. So it's more of a norm for the various states to get more detailed, more than what's in the NMLS database.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what keeps us in business is that these states, as I mentioned earlier, are trying to streamline the process, but they have certain laws that they're having to comply with. That their state legislatures passed. And so there's still additional things that they have to get that other states maybe don't need to have us provide to them.
Well, this is a good point when there's a change of control to interject that, because there's a new license. And then if a company has been bought or sold and there is a change of ownership, that can we'll talk about that. What are the levels of What extra work is done, or is it a minimal, easy process in most states when there's a change of control or a purchase of a company? What's the process there?
So anytime a company changes their ownership, their officers, even their address, they need to give advance notice. Another one is if they were to add a DBA or change their legal name. Anytime they make a major change like that, they have to give advance notice to all the states that they're licensed in, anywhere from as little as 10 days to as much as 120 days in some states. For an ownership change specifically, if a company is planning on doing that, they really need to plan ahead. In fact, just in the last few months, we've had some people contact us and say, hey, we made an ownership change a few months ago. What do we do? And it creates a tricky situation because now they need to disclose to the states that they didn't tell them up front, didn't get prior approval for that change, didn't get the new owners vetted by the states, and it could result in any number of actions by the state, such as a fine or suspension of a license or even revoking of a license if the state determines that they took way too long to report this. So it's important to just plan those things up front, any sort of changes that require advance notice, and to do it properly and make sure you're getting all the information into each state that they require for those changes.
Let's get over to company financials. Majority of states have some minimum net worth requirement, and that can vary from state to state and the makeup of the balance sheet. Talk to that, please.
So each state requires a different net worth. The highest in any state is $250,000. If you want to be able to lend FHA loans, then that's $1 million. And then if you want to be able to sell to Fannie or Freddie, last I checked, it was $2.5 million.
Yep.
So, but for the state licensing, the highest is $250,000 for any state. So if you have that, you're good. If not, then you really have to take a look at the net worth requirements before starting the process in any of those states.
So there is that can range pretty dramatic range of what the net worth requirements are. What about the makeup of the balance sheet? I mean, for example, assets. Some companies say, well, I'm going to put in real estate. I'm going to put in some art that's worth something. I've seen all kinds of things go into that. Is the state care about what type of assets are on the balance sheet and how much liquidity is there? Or, like a warehouse lender, they're very specific. They discount those things or give them next to nothing value because they're wanting liquidity. So talk about liquidity versus more fixed assets.
Yeah, so the states generally are not concerned with liquidity. FHA is. FHA requires 20% liquidity, but the states don't. And so when trying to get licensed in the states, you can definitely be creative and invest some personal assets into the company. It's funny, one of the most common questions we get is, can we just provide personal financials on the owner in order to show the net worth? And the answer is no, the assets have to be held by the company. And so you have to invest those personal assets into the company in order for them to be included in the net worth calculation. We had a company a few years back where the owner had a Ferrari, I think it was, and, or maybe it was a Lamborghini, I can't remember. But anyway, it was a second car of his, and he said he actually did use it to drive around to customers and things. And so he put it in the company's name. State accepted it as long as the title was transferred with the DMV into the name of the company, as well as the insurance showing that it was owned by the company, not the owner of the company. And so generally the states are fairly flexible on that. The only things we generally see the states say, say no on, and if you talk to your accountant, they would probably say you can't do that either, is putting your primary home in the company's name.
Right.
Or if you have just one car, putting your primary car that's used, generally for your personal use, into the company name. But any other assets that you have are usually fair game. But I do always recommend, if you're trying to get creative with that, to just talk to your accountant to make sure that they recommend that as well.
That's a really good point. It's always interesting to see what can go into these companies. Articles and corporations, basic information like the quality control plan, business plan. Talk about that briefly, all the various documentations that go into a final application.
Yeah. So in addition to filling out all of the company's information on the NMLS, such as the company's name and address and that type of information, a lot of the states require additional documentation to be sent to them outside of the NMLS. And that's streamlined a lot in the last 10 years. A lot of the states, we would have half an inch of paperwork that had to be mailed in to them. And a lot of the states realized that it was very duplicative and a lot of it was unnecessary. So we've seen a lot of the states eliminate those types of things. But many of them still require that. They're definitely going to require, in most states, a business plan. And it doesn't have to be extremely elegant. You're not trying to convince them to do business with you. You're just trying to explain to them that you're going to be operating a traditional mortgage company and you don't have to go into extreme detail. Many of the states may ask for policies and procedures, AML policies or quality control policies or whatever it is that particular state is focusing on. And in some of those cases, it's good to have an outside consultant take a look at that, because those are the areas that the state's going to examine you in a few years. And you want to make sure you have policies and procedures that are compliant with the state's requirements, so you don't run into any issues when the state examines you. And we help with the whole process from start to finish, but that one area we generally refer people out is if they don't have policies and procedures that are specific to their company in regards to some of those compliance areas, we'll generally refer them to a compliance consultant that's familiar with the current issues in that particular state.
Yeah, it's important because it can vary state by state in some cases.
Yeah, definitely. There's some states that don't ask for any of that type of information up front, but we'll look at it if they examine you later. And then some states that do ask for that information to review it. And you don't want to just throw something together that you got from another company and just send it into the state, because, again, they're going to be examining you on those policies and procedures later. And so you want to make sure you're actually implementing those and following those procedures.
I'm chuckling because you and I both have seen companies submit a quote-unquote quality control plan that's been given a lot of thought, and then you look inside of it and it's got some other company's name in there. It's obviously they just pulled one off the internet or from some other source and just dropped it in their plan and have not given it the appropriate thought. So it's really important, listeners, that if you're looking to start a business, that you do this and you are thoroughly familiar with it. You're going to be, as Stephen just said, audited on what you say. So think it all the way through. Stan, that's just so interesting. What is the cost of most state applications right now?
So they're usually between about a few $100 to a few $1,000s per state. So that's definitely something to look at as you're looking at to expand.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good wide range, and it's important to get that. You, again, walk them through that. So not all states are created equal when it comes to getting approved. And is the MLS leveling out the playing field in this area when it comes to the application process?
To a degree, the NMLS has caused the states to rethink areas where they're really duplicating things or asking for so many more things than other states that are unnecessary. So it's helped to a degree. But like I mentioned at the beginning of the call, one thing it's caused is it's caused the states to somewhat reduce their staff in some states because they're thinking they don't need as much staff because the process is a little bit more streamlined on their end. And so the staff sometimes is not as responsive, but and then sometimes also gives deadlines on applications. So there's still a lot of complexity with this and making sure that when you submit an application, you have everything you need up front and you don't have a state come back to you and give you a 2-week deadline to get them something that you can't get for 3 weeks. So it's very important to make sure you're coordinating these things up front so you don't lose a couple $1,000 in fees that you paid and having to reapply.
Yeah, if you get rejected, you don't get that fee back. I mean, that fee is out. And so important that you get some guidance on this. So when it comes to acquiring a license, is it as simple as just sending an application to the state and waiting for the license to come? Or is it a whole lot more complicated?
For the average state application we work on, it's a few weeks of prep to get everything together and get the proper things in place with the Secretary of State, with the registered agent, with the surety bond company on the NMLS, getting all that together, everything from the customer to be able to apply. And then once we submit an application, it's usually 1 to 2 months for most states to review everything. And 95% of the time, they want one or two other little things in addition to what we already sent in.
Wow.
They have questions on the application. And probably about the other 5% of the time, they want 5 or 10 things, depending on the state agency. And then once we get those things in, sometimes there's some back and forth. And then we finally get approval of the license after a couple months. Still a handful of states that take longer, 4 to 6 months even, for approval of a license. And then you've, of course, got,
what
you've
states
got New
are,
York, which is even
yeah,
longer.
New York is one of them. What's some of the others that are just real large in this longer time frame?
Yeah, Virginia is about 5 to 6 months. Nevada is about the same. California, if you need the residential mortgage lender license, which generally most companies don't need, most get the BRE or the CFL license in California. But if you need the residential mortgage lender license for the type of business activities you're conducting, that's taking up to a year. And then New York, the broker license is taking about a year, and the banker license is still taking about 2 to 3 years if you have the
wow.
right connections and law firms in New York that are coordinating that process for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me. We've helped companies and worked with consultant companies getting approved in New York, and it is really amazing. When you have the right connections, and you probably one of the best connections to doing it right, there are law firms out there that profess, and I've seen it several times, they actually can rush things through and because of that whole New York thing. So it's pay the fee, and you can get it done more quickly. But, I mean, I think that you've created some real realistic expectations. When it comes to connections, is this something where they say, hey, if I just slip this guy some extra money or work with this, is there any way to, you know, expedite it?
Yeah, really the only way to expedite it is for the mortgage company owners and officers to be really responsive. And we see applications that take months and months to get approved only because we needed a signature or fingerprint card from someone, and we weren't even able to submit the application until we got that. So that's really the only thing that can be done. Once the application is in, then definitely connecting with the state and following up with them. You'd be surprised how many times we make a call or send an email, and all of a sudden it gets approved within 2 days because it was just sitting on someone's desk and they forgot about it. And a little bit of a push. Not that we have any major sway with them, but you know, they do know us because we work with them quite a bit. But more just that the a lot of times we're dealing with state agencies, and they're not as they're not as pressured as we are in the business industry to move things along at a quick pace. And so they may have things just sitting around there, and a little push, a little check of status will sometimes get things moving along.
Talk about the filing of the application.
So when completing the paperwork, it's really critical that we have complete application when we submit it. Really eliminates, you know, a state requesting 20 or 30 things or even an application being abandoned because there's something that the state asked for and we're just not going to be able to get it in time. So it's really critical to have a complete application. Similar to if you were to submit a loan to an underwriter, you don't want to submit one thing at a time because when they touch it 10 times, they're not going to be very happy with you. They're going to take less. You're going to focus less on it. They're going to set it aside and say, oh, I don't really want to touch this person's file right now. I'm going to get someone else's done. And so it is very important to try to eliminate too many touches by the states and get a complete application into them up front.
And this is also helpful, such helpful information. You have a trained staff to handle all the paperwork, and you already have good established relationships with all of these states. And specifically at HUD, you do an amazing job on the HUD applications. And I'm just such an honor to work with you because of your expertise. And really, I think it's your personality and how you approach. People get a sense in this interview just how easy you are to work with and friendly. And I think that really bodes well with the state, because the demanding, I got to have my license, you work for me kind of attitude doesn't work so well with a lot of these states. These are my people that aren't at the highest pay scale, and they look at that a lot of mortgage lenders and how much we make. And I think it's really important to find someone like Stephen to work with, listeners. So, Stephen, let's go to this again as we wrap this up. You know, best way to reach you and your website, phone number, and email address again.
Sure. So the website is integritymortgagelicensing.com, and you can call me anytime. My number is 714-721-3963. And my email is Stephen with a V at imlicensing.com. And feel free to connect with me anytime. There's lots of information on our website as well. You can click on the states page and you can review any of the states' company licensing requirements and costs. And you can also review, there's a lot of other good information on our website about how all this process works.
I know I can anticipate this as a question that's going to come up once we air this recording, but what is the general cost? Is there a cost per state? Is there a cost per a group of states? If you're doing a group, is there discounts on your services, or do you do everything on an hourly basis?
We do the new company licensing on a flat fee basis. If you're doing just one state, it's $8.95. 2 to 4 states is $7.75 each. And 5 to 9 is $6.75, and it just gets cheaper as you do more. And we do it that way just because it's very difficult to gauge the time that's going to need to go into a particular state application or for the particular company's ownership structure scenario. And so we feel more comfortable. We're able to give customers an exact fee up front when they start working with us.
Friendly, factual, experienced, and has a great track record. Folks, if you're looking for someone to help you with your licensing needs, I encourage you to get a hold of Stephen and talk with his team. Stephen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
I tell you, I was interested in that interview from the standpoint we're getting so many requests for people to open up new companies. I've never seen... Well, I can't say I've never seen it. It's like it was back in 2003, 2004, 5, 6, where so many people were getting back in the mortgage industry. And I think it's because either getting back in or they were exiting as top producers and they're wanting to set up their own mortgage company. That trend is back and alive. It sure seems so based on how the phone calls we're getting. So we wanted to share this information. Hope you found it helpful. If you know of someone who is looking to start up a mortgage company or want to go out on their own, I encourage you to share this podcast. Again, you can listen to this segment in the Hot Topic segment. So if you go to the Licking and Lending podcast and then you go there on the Hot Topic segment, you will see the drop down. The first item there, as you can see, Alice, Andy, Joe, Tom, everybody. Anyone who's contributing to the podcast, their segments are there. But the Hot Topic segment, you can listen to just that segment or any of the other segments and a list of them. Anyway, good to have you with us, everybody. Next week, we're going to be at the Lenders One Conference. We're going to be interviewing the new president, Brian Simon. So I'm looking forward to that. And then hopefully going to get Rob Crispin to stop by. He'll be at the conference with us again, good friend and someone we all read regularly. Check out next week's podcast when we're live at the Lenders One Conference. Again, a special thank you to our sponsors, Black Knight, Open Mortgage, Finastra, the MBA, Lenders One, the Mortgage Collaborative, Velma, the Knowledge Group, and Vidyard. Have a great week, everybody. Look forward to seeing you back here next week.
You've been listening to Licking on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Licking of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening. You've just heard an audio clip from Lickin' on Lending, and here are the sponsors that make this show possible.
Stories help customers relax and listen. They're memorable, they establish trust, and most importantly, they speak to the part of the brain where decisions are made. We make subconscious, emotional, and sometimes irrational decisions with one part of our brain. Then we justify those decisions with another. Stories provide depth and context to facts, which leads people to making secure and informed decisions. One poll found 30% of strangers are trustworthy. But when you asked what percentage of people you know, the median answer jumped to 70%. Telling a story is the most effective way to make someone feel like they know you. Stories provide glimpses into your world and invite your customers to tell you their stories. This cements trust between the parties, and once you have a customer's trust, you've usually got their business. A 2013 study found that only 1 in 5 sales calls provides enough stories to satisfy the customer. So why tell a story? Because it works. If this sounds too good to be true, it's not. It's just the science of sales.
I love that segment. Good job. Always love hearing that. And by the way, Scott's going to be our guest on the Hot Topic segment on February 18th next week. Looking forward to having him on. He's talking about educational content and some things that they're doing over at Open Mortgage. Very exciting.